You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the past couple of hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, that radio show that squeezes a lemon of new cinema releases until the peeps squeak and sequelize. My name is Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Simon West.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
Ed Elliott.
Hello.
And Jack Toy.
Hello.
The new films being discussed on the show today offer lives full of promises and lives filled with regret. Tom Courtney and Charlotte Rampling are the long married couple finally facing up to the ghosts of the past in drama 45 Years, the new film from the very promising British director Andrew Hay. Young Love leads a raggle-taggle collection of high school seniors on an all-American road trip in paper towns. And the cutting edge of hip-hop battles the straight-laced dramatic conventions of the musical biopic in Straight Outta Compton. Plus, with only a few days to go until the 35th Cambridge Film Festival opens its doors, we've two more previews of coming attractions. We speak to filmmaker Alison Rose, whose feature documentary Starmen will open the festival this Thursday. And we look into the world of early 3D, and we're talking 3D at the dawn of cinema, speaking to archivist and historian Bob Fulmanick about the festival's screening of 3D rarities. So, lots to come, but we start by blowing up the party balloons.
It's a shame not to have more photos around the house. Well, I guess we didn't see the point of taking pictures of ourselves. It's a shame.
Come on.
What are you doing?
Come on.
I'm not prancing around in the living room at this time of night.
This really is a great venue for an anniversary. So full of history, you see. Like a good marriage.
What is it?
They found her. You know who I'm talking about, don't you?
We never talked about it in all the years that we've known each other. And it's tainted everything.
You didn't know her?
No. I didn't.
The 2011 release of Weekend, A Bittersweet Brief Encounter of Gay Romance, introduced Andrew Hay as a director of unusual clarity and sensitivity. But where Weekend captured the tensions in a brand new relationship, Hay's new film, 45 Years, explores the cracks in a relationship that seems as settled as the landscape. Adapted by Hay from a short story by David Constantine, 45 Years stars Tom Courtney and Charlotte Rampling as Jeff and Kate Mercer, a middle-class couple comfortably snug after nearly half a century of marriage. Kate is a former head teacher. She seems unable to lose her strict poise even when just walking the dog. Whilst Jeff, a long-retired trade unionist, potters about the couple's Norfolk home looking for anything broken or busted that might need repair. But as celebrations for their 45th anniversary party are slotting into place, a letter for Jeff arrives from Germany, a letter which brings news of a long-lost love. Jack, Andrew Hay's follow-up to Weekend has been a long time coming and much anticipated. I think he went off to HBO and did some work for them and has come back to Britain for this. Does 45 Years show the same delicate touch as his debut? Because it's a shift in generations rather than anything else.
I'm conflicted with this. Yes, it does show the same delicate touch, but I think subject matter wise, didn't hook me at all. And I watched this film up at Edinburgh Film Festival. The audience seemed to like it. I found it was the scariest film I saw at Edinburgh, more than a horror film. It was the most depressing, melancholy film I saw there. And I actually turned to the couple sat next to me, who I believe were from the distributor, and I said, kind of, who is this film for? Is this film for someone like me? I'm 28, I'm a guy. And they said, no, it's not really for you. It's for, like, the Grey Pound. Like, it is aimed at them. And I couldn't see...
Crikey, really? How depressing.
I couldn't see a 16-year-old getting into cinema wanting to go and see this film because it's kind of bleak. Like, it's... In terms of outlook on life, the way everything unravels, I don't think it's a happy film, and I wouldn't
watch it again. But that's not a criteria. That's an odd way to judge a cinema whether something's a success or not. It's trying to be those things. It's not how lives unravel. It's how the compromises that a relationship of this length has to be. How many compromises have to be fitted into it? It's a grown-up film. I'm surprised they should have just said it's rather depressing. They said the Grey Pound, like they've pigeonholed every single generation to how much money they can make from it. It's just a grown-up film. I would have thought. Bewildered by that, depressed by that response from the distributor.
I think I was more depressed by the film, to be honest. I don't know, if your idea of spending an hour and a half of your life is to watch a very old couple kind of spin apart from each other over a revelation like a skeleton in their closet from 45 years ago and all of their life together has been for naught, apparently.
Really? You take that take that bleaker message from it? That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you're wrong. And it might be inside, but I'm not voicing. No, that's very interesting. I was wondering if you'd have the same sort of reaction to this as you had as to Love is Strange, which is a film I greatly liked and deals with another relationship of a similar age that sort of crumbles for different reasons. And
I found Love is Strange far more boring. I found elements of this film mundane. Like, do we really want to watch an elderly, middle-class, white couple in their very comfortable home kind of pottering around the place? You just go visit your grandparents for that. I'm not sure, like, as a subject matter, that interests me. Maybe it would interest someone from another culture to see how elderly British people go about their daily lives. But for me, that's not the exoticism of cinema. It's dull and depressing.
Ed, I'm speechless. That's it. All right. It works for radio. It's not a joke that really works for radio, or can it only work on radio? It's almost a ghost story, 45 years. Certainly the first half you can read as it's modelled on a ghost story. It's about a lady who finds her husband's possessed in many ways, and she doesn't know what to do about it. Some parts of it are even filmed like a ghost story.
I was going to say, there is a strange horror thriller aspect to it, where there's the musical turns and the movement of the camera around an empty house has aspects of leaning towards horror. It's definitely a film that is after the act, and the act has been a long time ago. Strangely, I completely disagree with Jack. I don't think the problem is it's... That's not to say that I really like the film. I think it has a lot of problems. But I think actually it's sort of depressingness, its willingness to delve into areas which are dark, and also twin that with a subject matter of, you know, elderly people and marriage, people who have been in a marriage for a long time, often things which are presented in a much, you know, stuff like you know, much lighter light for, you know, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and Quartet and stuff like that, which is much lighter, I thought was really interesting. I think the story is really, really interesting. My problem with it is that it is less delicate than the way it appears at the beginning and the way that I hoped that it would unfold. The way that it's shot in the first 20 minutes has a kind of an austere feel to it, a restrained feel. There's a lot of long takes and the camera's held quite far away from the people within the drama, giving it sort of mirrors the characters in themselves, very austere figures who aren't giving away their emotions. However, as the narrative unfolded, as the trailer showed, actually, just doing the trailer, they start to speak their emotions far too much rather than show them or act them.
Really? I don't find that with Jeff at all. He barely speaks.
I think Jeff less so, but I think Kate definitely. I mean, in the trailer there's that line, you know, she's been sitting in the corner throughout our whole relationship and it's tainted everything, where I kind of feel like you could have just acted that. You didn't need to say that. There are too many times when things are given to us far too obviously.
I agree with that point, but it's one of the few salient points in the film where the drama is handed to us. The rest of the time it's there, but it's there in subtext or in composition. It's very rare. I mean, in the end, you don't, you're left to question exactly what stage you're. I don't think it's a relationship that's crumbled. Mm. I think it's just a relationship that's had to find a new footing as it enters the twilight of it.
Mm. The ending is ambiguous, and I came back on board at the ending. I think the last scene, not to give away a huge amount of what it is, but they're building towards a party and it's involved at the party, is a very well constructed and is a return to what happens at the beginning, where you can't quite tell exactly what the characters are thinking. I just found that the emotions that I was getting from Kate and Jeff were far too simplistic. The ones that I really felt, and admittedly, I say this is not a film for me, much like it's probably not a film for Jeff.
No, I don't understand it. How is it not a film for you? This is not a film. Andrew Hayden, who's my age, didn't set out to make a film for the Grey Pound, no matter what the distributors have cynically decided upon. I'm obviously going to take that one phrase and shake it. But it's a film. It's in the lineage of Make Way for Tomorrow or any of the films about that age group.
What I'm trying to say is the characters are very far away in life terms than I am. I couldn't be further away from Kate. Yeah, it's almost impossible to be further away from where Kate is than I am at the moment. And I found it difficult to relate to her, where she was in life and what she was feeling, beyond just the simple emotions of sadness, anger, frustration. I wanted something deeper, more complex. And I felt like the narrative struggled to delve into moments that, where she was trying to hold things back. The bit, it went too easily into moments where she was just expressing sadness or expressing anger, and not the bits where she was just sort of holding it in.
I think you're really underselling that character. I think I don't feel it was that simplistic at all. I will come back to this, but Jack, probably round about 5 minutes before the end of the show. It surprised me a little bit, Jack, in the fact that it's the very first scene, well, other than the scene of Charlotte rambling, walking her dog, but as soon as she gets home, so the very first scene of the two of them together is when the letter arrives from Germany. So I wasn't quite expecting that. I thought it would be 10 minutes into the film. It's an unusual decision in that we don't see their marriage, not happy, but we don't see their marriage functioning at its normal heart rate. We see it at the moment the fracture appears. Do you think that's one that you don't have anything that contrast?
And yet we see the framework of their marriage all around them, i.e. they've been together for 45 years, they own this house, they've had these successful careers, they've obviously come up, as anyone in a relationship would over that amount of time, with kind of pitfalls that they've managed to step across, and yet it's this instance which seems to break everything. And I don't know, I found that utterly, utterly bleak. I believe it's an adaptation of a short story.
Yes, it is.
So maybe that's just how the short story pans out. I don't know. I don't want to read the short story because I've seen enough of it. And don't get me wrong, I love Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay. I think they're great actors. They do a very good job in the film. It's the subject matter I don't like. And I mean, good on Tom Courtenay and Charlotte for that sex scene. I mean, it's one of the most awkward sex scenes I've seen in cinema.
Really? Again, I think that's been over-egged by press eager to talk about something, to write a think piece about something. I've seen similar scenes in other films. It seems a bit... I don't know. Anyway, that's a side point. It's an impressive scene. It's a good. It's one of many interesting and vital scenes that we don't see very often in mainstream cinema, perhaps. And I think this is a fairly mainstream film.
But that scene is preceded by a scene where they... where they're kind of meant to be getting back together for a moment, the sort of high points in their relationship where they kind of have a dance in the kitchen. And it was scenes like that which I thought were heavy-handed. Like, we've seen that.
I know, because I don't... I think they're only heavy-handed because...
I don't think elderly couples would actually do that. I don't know. That didn't seem natural to me. It was sort of an easy way of going, now they're happy. They're kind of together.
No. I didn't read that at all. Mm. I didn't... I think it's very rare for me to disagree with the reviewers, and yeah. It's usually me shouting something down is garbage. It's not a situation I'm happy with. But I think this is a huge. I have issues with the third act. Maybe I don't know with one revelation that seems to take Charlotte Rampling's character in a direction I'm not particularly that I've seen before. But I thought that certainly in terms of Jeff's character, this is a hugely subtle film, and I think personally, you're only reading one level of it, and that's why it seems rather simplistic. But in my in your defense, I am older, so I am nearer Jeff in your logic.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is I do think that Tom Courtney gives the really star performance in this film. I think that he is fantastic.
But do you think
he is a very, very interesting and complex character. I think there is a lot there which is very interesting. I think that being set in Norfolk, this very flat area, very grey area, Tom Courtney, his character talking about life and elderly age and how there are less decisions, that is, you know, it's a less
big
dramatic
decisions.
Landscape. And it's interesting that that's paired with the Swiss Alps of the past, which is obviously a very dramatic, very vivid landscape where all these other things have happened, which is paired up in the speech at the end. I think that there is a lot of interesting things going on. Purely on an emotional level, I felt that it began at a really high height. Maybe this is why I'm a little bit disappointed. I thought it began at a really interesting place where it was doing aesthetically very, very interesting things that were twinned with the way in which the subject that it was telling, and it dropped off and went to stuff like very easy close-ups, very
but it gets thematically much more interesting as it goes on. I would sit Tom Courtney's Jeff's character and the writing of that and the permutations his character goes through, and he is the silent partner in this relationship in this film. I would sit that alongside the examination of the male's egos in Force Majeure, which we had earlier this year. I think it's a fascinating glimpse of how a man, and he's a sort of a failure of a man. He's a little bit of he's a trade unionist, but you get a feeling he's been all mouth and no trousers. He hasn't really achieved very much, while she quietly has achieved quite a lot in her chosen
field.
But
would you say the same thing about Kate? Is my question, because I think Tom Courtney's character, as I've said, is a really interesting character. I don't feel the same way about Kate, and she is meant to be the centre of the drama. I think there is a lot of interesting thing there about being the head teacher, about being the person who's used to telling other people what they do.
I think that
comes
through.
And is now struggling with telling herself what to do. I think that is interesting, but it's not dealt with enough. And she very quickly crumbles into a character who is now I'm sort of unsure of where I am.
I think it pulls itself out of that. I sort of agree for the first half. I thought, and I did scribble in my notes, where's her self-belief? As soon as she finds, it's not that she's found out, but as soon as she is Tom Courtney says, oh, they found my they found my ex-girlfriend buried in the ice as she was when she was lost, which is an amazing image, amazing idea. But they've had 45 years together. She wouldn't crumble like this unless those 45 years have only been sparsely happy and she's always been uncertain. I think the film sort of does suggest she's always been on the edge of uncertainty for those 45 years, and what you learn to compromise with, what you learn, and the fact that she doesn't even know her husband that well, the idea that he's going to give him a watch and he says, I never really know, I like not knowing what the time is. You know, she's taken on the sort of high position here as if she's a wronged housewife, which she isn't, a wronged spouse, but she's got her faults as well. I think the film very delicately, and the beautiful scene where she plays the piano, and then she can play it by the muscle memory, and the fact that she's doing the same thing Tom Courtney's character does. You can't escape that muscle memory. He's not being unfaithful. He just cannot. I find it a thematically rich one. I don't think it's a film last word, the sound design, a technical thing. It doesn't have any music. There's no score for this film, except the music they listen to the radio, which is all music of their youth.
The diegetic sound, is that the right way of describing it?
Music of the environment, so the ambient noises. Yeah. The bird song is particularly heavy. Sometimes it feels like the house is being crushed by the encroaching nature.
Moments when dialogue overlaps into the preceding scene, which again is kind of more of a horror film technique, which going back all the way to the beginning of this talk on this film, it has got those elements. I mean, I think that we've kind of become more it's entrenched in our positions through the facts that we're opposing in opinions. I don't think it's a terrible film. I think it's perfectly fine. And if maybe, you know, you're of the 30, 40, 50 years old, slightly
That's
different.
How old are you, Toby?
You, but,
this is like Logan's Run.
Sorry, I'm not trying to, you know. Sorry, I think it's perfectly fine film. I don't think it's as interesting as you think it is. I think that's where I would sit.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I think we've got a film coming up here on today's show that will have a far wider reach for an audience than 45 years will.
I don't think that's the hallmark of good or bad cinema.
Straight out of Norfolk.
Okay, all right.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's all right. It's all right.
So we're doing that one out of...
No, we're not doing marks. We're not going to go down that road. We're going to wrap this up and move on. Okay, 45 years opened yesterday and is now showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 15. Okay, if you're a regular listener, you'll know by now that the 35th Cambridge Film Festival begins in only a few days. Opening on September the 3rd, the festival runs for 11 days, screening well over 100 films at a variety of venues around Cambridge. And among those many and various and wonderful films will be a rare chance to see some very early examples of 3D cinema. Showing on the Monday and the first Friday of the festival is 3D Rarities, 90 minutes of restored 3D film, including the earliest existing 3D film from 1922, 3D animation, including Casper the Friendly Ghost, 3D design from the great William Cameron Menzies, and 3D burlesque comedy that's been unseen for half a decade. It's a 3D bonanza. I spoke to Bob Firmenich, film archivist and historian, and somebody who spent the last 30 or so years recovering the lost history of early 3D. It is due to his work that 3D Rarities even exists. Speaking from his home in New Jersey, Bob went into details of the two early technical processes of 3D, Polaroid projection and the cheaper, more familiar anaglyphic technique, which is where you've got the glasses with the coloured lenses. He also spoke about the work that goes into finding old 3D prints, but he began by explaining the roots of cinematic 3D and that they go back further than you can imagine.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Lloyd Nolan. You know, I feel very privileged that I am about to become the first actor ever to appear before the public in natural vision, three dimension. Now, I assume that you all have your magic glasses on. They really are magic.
There were testing and experiments done even before the turn of the last century. But the date that we're going by for the centennial celebration is June 10th, 1915. And that is the first date of a documented public exhibition of a 3D film on film. It took place in New York City at the Astor Theater in Times Square. And three reels of footage were shown to an invited audience, and it was in the original red and green anaglyphic 3D system. And the material was very well received, but there were technical issues which prevented it from becoming more mainstream, and it wasn't until 1922 when the film stock was available that enabled filmmakers to put both the red and green images on one strip of film. And that's when the first 3D feature was done, called The Power of Love. Now, that feature is lost, and the test footage from 1915 does not survive. But what we have in 3D Rarities, and what your viewers will have a chance to see at the festival, is the earliest existing 3D footage, which dates back to 1922. And it's footage that was shot in Washington, D.C., in New York City, and it was called Kelly's Plasticon Pictures. And it's really some remarkable footage that has gotten a great response from people because, first, they don't realize that 3D and good quality 3D film goes back that far in the history of cinema.
What do you think drove these early attempts at 3D? Because film history promotes the idea that once filming and projecting the moving picture had been achieved, everything else following that was just gimmick. Was this very early 3D, do you think, driven by engineers trying to perfect their idea of cinema? Marketing men looking for another angle?
There was a real dedicated effort by the pioneers to make the movies as realistic as possible, and that was color. Experiments and sound were going on at the same time, and 3D was as much a part of that. You have to remember that 3D photography dates back to the 1860s, 1870s, and it was a very popular trend for people to have these stereoscopes in their living rooms or their parlors, and they would look at these stereo images taken around the world so they could see something that perhaps most people couldn't afford to see in person, but through the, you know, the new magic of 3D photography, they could go to Egypt or Africa and look at these wonderful stereo images. So I think the attempt to translate that to film was there from the very earliest days, and it was really only the limitations of the technology that kept the pioneer cinematographers from realizing that goal.
So what is exactly screening in the 3D rarities package at the film festival? It's not just a collection of short test films, but rather the 90-minute package that is at the festival is almost the whole world of unexplored cinema. There are many, many genres represented.
3D rarities is a real cross-section of what was done in the experimental years and what Hollywood was doing. And we have some fantastic films that were done by Paramount Studios, for instance, with the Casper cartoon Boo Moon, which is a beautiful example of 3D animation.
Gosh, I wish people wouldn't be scared of me.
But we have trailers for some of the classic 3D films, like It Came from Outer Space and Miss Sadie Thompson, and we have the first and only 3D newsreel called Doomtown, which is a fascinating anti-atomic short about the dangers of atomic energy, and it's not a flag waver, which so many of the industrial films were at that time.
Ladies and gentlemen, the events that I'm about to describe are going to sound incredible to most people, but I know they happened. I saw them happen.
Are there fundamental differences in how the 3D of these earlier films that we're talking about compares to the 3D of the blockbusters of today's summer? It seems, going through your website, that the preferred method before the early 50s was anaglyphic, where the image was broken into both red and cyan, or red and blue, and they were combined in projection. There were two projectors. And then after that, from 1951 onwards, there was Polaroid projection system, which Polaroid developed, which was a lot better and used clear filtered lenses for the glasses. And then it seemed to drift back towards an anaglyphic presentation of 3D simply because it was cheaper. Is that roundabout what happened?
You're very accurate. Anaglyphic 3D with the red and blue, or sometimes red and green glasses, was used primarily from the 1920s through about 1935. And then from that point forward, polarized 3D was used, which was first introduced in January of 1936. So all of the features that were initially released were shown in polarized 3D. And it wasn't until the 1970s when anaglyphic kind of came back on the scene because, as you mentioned, it was cheaper. It was easier to project. It didn't require two machines interlocked. And in the 1980s, half a dozen or so of the original 3D features were converted to anaglyphic for television broadcast. In fact, some people have even taken that iconic Life magazine image of the people at the world premiere of Bwana Devil, and they're wearing Polaroid glasses, but they've colored the glasses red and green, just because that's the myth now, and that's what people believe. So over the years, there's been a great deal of confusion, and kind of this myth has built up that all of the vintage 3D films were anaglyphic. We've tried very hard over the last 15 or so years to let people know that, no, these films were seen in a very high-quality polarized 3D system, and that's what we have represented and released on 3D rarities.
To wrap up, why do you think it is that 3D has been treated by critics with such a dismissive attitude? You said earlier that it had been developed in the early days of cinema alongside color, but it's never been given the historical importance that perhaps it should have been done. Is that because for so long there were so many missing examples of the best examples of the technology, do you think?
3D has always been considered the redheaded stepchild of technology and innovation in cinema. And it's always been sound and widescreen that have gotten the accolades. So I think that has been a very difficult obstacle for the technology to overcome. And unfortunately, what's happening today with the current 3D product is the filmmakers and cinematographers are so reluctant to give a real immersive 3D experience on screen that they're effectively cutting back on the amount of depth that the new 3D films. And a lot of people say the current 3D trend is more 2.5D. That's been one of the delightful things with not only 3D rarities, but the other restorations we've done, is people are having a chance now to look at what was done 60, 70, even 80 years ago and realize just how realistic and how deep the 3D image is. It's quite a contrast to the films that are being made today. And, you know, hopefully some filmmakers will start paying attention as well.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many, many thanks to Bob for the interview. It's really wonderful to send an email to a stranger half a world away and have them enthusiastically engage in conversation. It's quite incredible. Very enjoyable. 3D rarity screening at the Cambridge Film Festival has three dates. There's one on Friday the 4th at 6:30, which is at the Light Cinema, and that is the one that's alongside the animated short One Night in Hell, which stars Brian May, the Queen guitarist and longtime enthusiast for early stereoscopic imagery. And Brian May will be at the Light screening to sign copies of that particular book. And 3D rarities will be alone at screening at the Arts Picture House on Monday the 7th. Two screenings then, 11:30 in the morning and 11 p.m. at night, and they'll both be in Screen 2, which is the screen that can handle 3D. It is on page 6 of the festival programme.
East Anglia's biggest unsigned music festival is coming this weekend, and Cambridge 105 will be there. Across Saturday and Sunday, we'll be broadcasting live backstage at Homegrown Music Festival, bringing performances direct from the stage from artists including headliners Big Ten and The Downsetters, alongside Cambridge 105 favourites Polar Collective, The Staycations, The Abstracts, Gold Star vs. Grace Sarah, and many more. There'll also be live interviews and acoustic sets too. Join us this bank holiday weekend for Homegrown Music Festival on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Simon West, Dave Riley, Ed Elliott and Jack Toy. Rather amazingly, there isn't much on Cambridge 105 today. There are, in fact, only two things. Once we're all done at 1 p.m, as you've just heard, we make room for MMG at the Homegrown Festival, live coverage from East Anglia's busiest festival of unsigned musical talent. Then, from between 4 and 5 p.m, it's 105 Sport, which is all the latest local and national football results, as well as anything else going on in the sporting calendar. And from 5 to 11 o'clock at night, it's back to the Homegrown Festival. So that's all to come. We've still got another just under 30 minutes of Bums on Seats left, including a look at Starmen, the opening film of the Cambridge Film Festival, and a review of the NWA biopic Straight Outta Compton. But first, we feel the rush of young love.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. My miracle was I wound up living across the street from Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was inarguably the most gorgeous creature that God had ever created. Margot's life was a series of unbelievably epic adventures.
Are you going to spend the rest of high school pining for this girl?
As senior year drew to a close, Margot and I were practically strangers. Until this one night.
What the? Margot?
I need to borrow your car.
What?
I have 9 things I need to do tonight.
Can't you just get your boyfriend to do it?
Ex-boyfriend.
Not as weird as it looks.
Stop.
I can't believe you just did that.
Take the picture, now.
Okay, now that was fun.
I can feel my heart beating in my chest.
That is the way you should feel your whole life.
It's beautiful.
It's a paper town. Paper houses and paper people. Everything's uglier up close.
Not you. You think it's gonna be different in the morning?
I really hope so.
On the last Bums on Seats, a fortnight ago, we reviewed three films with the rarity of well-written and proactive female leads. But this week, cinema seems to be falling back into familiar habits with new release Paper Towns, a film which revolves around the convenient conceit of the perfect girl, the manic pixie dream girl, so beloved of modern romances. Adapted from the bestseller by John Green, Paper Towns stars actor Nate Wolff as Quentin Jacobson, a quiet high school senior facing the final prom on his own. He's still in love with the girl next door, Margot Spiegelman, played by Carla Delevingne, his best friend when growing up, but now a girl more often seen hanging with the cheerleaders and the jocks. But then one evening, Margot enlists Quentin's help in a night of prankish revenge on the friend she feels betrayed her. It seems a magical night of connection, but the following morning, Margot has vanished. Simon, Paper Towns sets itself up, you know, by the trailer certainly, as a sort of modern teen romance, a bit like Fault in Our Stars, which is also based on a John Green book. But it heads merrily off in a different direction altogether, really.
Yeah, it wasn't what I expected when I was going into it. I was expecting more of the, the teen drama, coming-of-age kind of film, like Perks of Being a Wallflower, or like I said, Falling in the Stars. But this actually turns into more of a, almost like a boy's own adventure, which in the end was a lot more enjoyable, I think. It didn't go too much on the angst and the growing up, although that was often in the background. It's, it was about Quentin's quest to try and find and track down Margot, following clues that she's left in a treasure hunt, literally a treasure hunt kind of sense.
And clues he thinks she's left. That's the crux of the pivot
possible,
of the film, really.
But it's not just like going out to search and all of that. It was actually a literal search, and I actually quite enjoyed it for that. One of the things I would praise the film for is mainly the supporting actors, who often do get the best parts in these kind of like these coming-of-age dramas and things like this. And again, Austin Abrams and Justin Smith as Ben and Ado are absolutely fantastic.
These are Quentin's best friends
and wingmen. And surprisingly, in this kind of film, actually seemed age-appropriate. They did seem to be the same age they were meant to be playing, which felt fresh and different, and they were really quite funny.
It's unusual to have... it is a strength of the film, or is a part of the film I enjoyed, at least, that it's very good at putting teenagers together. As you said, they're age appropriate. They're not 30-year-olds pretending to live in Beverly Hills or whatever. And it is very good at sort of capturing that sort of Goonies-like energy of just being able to go out and do something. But they're the most entitled children you can imagine. I mean, they seem to have absolutely no trouble in borrowing anything they need to borrow. They have endless bank accounts.
The American thing where it's like, they can drive at 16. So, yeah, a bunch of 16-year-olds, it's like, yes, we'll now go on a road trip from Florida to New York and borrow the parents' car for the weekend.
They can't do that over there. This is as much as a myth as Steve McQueen hunting down gangsters. They choose this New York road trip where they think Margot's character is, and they go off in the middle of the night, and Quentin rings his mother up on the hands-free and says a very teenagery thing to do, and says, we'll be back. We're just going up to... He doesn't even make up a lie. He just says, we're going to upstate New York, which just happens to be 1,500 miles away. And everybody's fine with it.
I know, it's convenient. The film is shot through that... that rose-tinted glasses about how great it is. You know, if you didn't have to worry about it, there aren't many worries about here. The biggest stress the kids have is going to prom. It's not quite true. It does actually deal with some real issues as well.
But that's the issue. That's the problem. Is it's trying to have its cake and eat it. It's not a Judd Apatow film about the children, teenager trying to lose their virginity. It's trying to be more of a Perks of the Wallflower realistic film. And it's trying to say something. It's self-aware about this, about Margot's character, that she is too good to be true. It's not a Meg Ryan character where she's just quirky because that's an easy character to put in front of an audience.
Yeah.
But it doesn't quite do enough with that self-awareness. It sort of backs off it.
I kind of like that. I mean, the fact that it was the entire hunt for, as you said, the manic pixie dream girl. Yet we all, discover and find out that it is it isn't real. It doesn't exist. It's not, you know, it's
but
not it's, true.
But the film does keep it in but existence
it, it
to a certain extent.
Especially, you know, I don't really want to give too much of the ending away, but it really does ground it. But I think this lightness of the film, it makes it a bit more palatable probably for the younger audience. You know, it's not. It could easily have been another heavy, you know, Perks or something like that, which, while, you know, while fantastic film, can be a bit heavy, this is a lot lighter and probably is skewing a bit younger, and I can't really floor it for that.
Dave, is it skewed? Do you think it could have skewed a bit older? What about if the 45 years audience? Should it have gone for the grey pound, do you think? It's got a problem
I
in that.
I feel qualified to comment on that.
It's what's this radio? We can be whatever age we say.
I did notice that all of us slightly older people sat up when the young 20-year-olds were making comments about age.
Cara Delevingne plays this character, and she's a model, and this is not quite her first film, but it's her first film as a major player, and she's perfectly fine. I quite enjoyed her performance. She's only really in it at the beginning, but she's set up as this perfect example of the woman you want to be with, that she'll take you on an adventure. She'll save you from yourself. Does the film then tries to undermine that and say that really isn't true? But it doesn't. Well, it feels like it's
quite clever in the way it does it, because it's looking at a relationship that never happens, basically, which is where you view everything through those rose-tinted glasses, and that maybe is applied to the entire film. It's not until, you know, at the end of the film, it's no surprise he does track her down, but she then goes and says, but you don't actually know anything about me.
Which is rubbish. I thought that was platitude, because he knows her better than she knows herself in one regard. He should have said, well, I don't, but I have what, you know, but you have lived next to me for the last 14 years.
It's the way she's like, you know, the surface me, because, you know, when we were kids, that was all you got. There's a bit quite early on when they're kids where they find someone who has shot themselves.
It's the very first scene, isn't it?
Yeah, she runs up to the body. I was convinced she was going to pick up a stick and poke it.
But she's ever so curious about this, and she remains curious. I don't quite buy the fact that she then falls into the crowd of jocks and cheerleaders. She doesn't blend in physically or in any regard. It feels like they'd always
be suspicious. She's a supermodel.
Yeah, I know, but she doesn't.
That's blending in physically.
She doesn't look like she lives in Orlando. She looks like a supermodel, which is, as you say, I don't know. I think it's because she's the character she's playing, Margot, is empty. She's not empty in the way she thinks she's empty. She our hero never picks up on this, but the film puts the parts in front of him. Right. She says this is a paper town, and everybody here is, you know, they don't mean anything. She's being quite unpleasant, but she doesn't see it as Radar, one of his radar. What's the character from MASH? That's what kept reminding me of. His parents collect black Santas, and he's too ashamed to bring his girlfriend over because of that. But his girlfriend says they're very progressive. That's a very interesting thing to do. That's an underneath of this town that Margot cannot see, because Margot's a bit empty, and the film lays those parts out and then doesn't do anything with it. He doesn't say, hold on, you know, I've now got evidence that actually the town's much more interesting if you're just not standing to the side and gloating like you are, Margot. I thought the film was going to go in that direction, but it then turns around and says, oh, we don't know where she is now, but I'm sure she's up to something mysterious. Well, you've just spent an hour and a half telling us that won't be the case. But silence. I've ranted again, haven't I? I do apologise.
That's fine.
Okay. All right. I don't know. All right. No, it's not good enough. Okay. All right. Well, Paper Towns, which is not good enough, opened last week, but is still screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 12A. Now, for our last pre-film festival preview, we have an interview with Alison Rose, producer, writer and director of the documentary Star Men, which is the festival's opening film. Star Men follows four English astronomers, Roger Griffin, Donald Bell, Nick Wolfe and Wal Sargeant, all in their late 70s, embarking on a road trip that mirrors the explorations they took as young English scientists stationed in America. Accompanied by Alison, they revisit their old walking routes and the telescopes, some now sadly fallen into disrepair, where they spend many, many nights getting to grips with the cosmos.
Speaking to me from her film studio in downtown Toronto, Alison explained her reasons for filming the trip and the difficulty in finding drama in the unsentimental logic of scientists. But she began by discussing what had brought her to the project in the first place.
I'm 76, and I'm aware that I will not live forever. And there are many things that I should still like to do. I like to follow my stars a lot longer than I have done already. Maybe I shall last a little time yet.
I wanted to make a particular kind of astronomy film. And so I was looking for a particular story that was going to occur naturally. And I didn't know what that was. But I was just sort of waiting to bump into it. And Starman is the film that I found. I knew one elderly British astronomer who lived in Arizona and whom I met making my first film. And then I met another elderly British astronomer, and I asked the second if he knew the first. And he said, "Know him? I'm planning a reunion with him. We're going to take a road trip." And he told me about the road trips they'd taken at when they all had research fellowships in California very early or at the beginning of their careers in 1960, and how at Christmas and Easter, rather than fly home, they had bought a car and explored the southwestern United States, going to visit observatories and hiking in national parks. They all liked hiking in mountains. And so the film weaves together basically five story threads. One was the old road trip. One was the new road trip. Another thread was the biographies, the stories of those four men. Another theme was 50 years in astronomy, the post-war 50 years in astronomy, which were the most exciting 50 years that astronomy has ever had. And the final fifth thread is my thread as the narrator and guide to the audience. That's basically what you see, is a weave of those five story threads. Some of them are a little thicker than others, which is appropriate.
Did the road trip with Donald and with Nick and with Wall and with Roger, did it take the shape you were expecting?
Initially, I wanted to just follow them on their road trip. And then later on, I revisited that and asked them to go to the VLA. I also asked them to go to California. I thought, for the purposes of the film and their biographies, for the story of astronomy in the 20th century, we had to go there. And I think that the structure of the film bears that out. There was a reason I wanted to go with them. I wanted to learn from them. There were questions I wanted to ask them about not just their science, in fact, less about their science and more about what they'd learned in a lifetime, what their thoughts were about life.
Starman features a whole lot of themes, as you've just mentioned, that many films, even documentaries, tend to avoid: age, mortality, science in a serious sense rather than a sort of summer blockbuster sense, and, as I mentioned earlier, joy and importance of reading, of education, of curiosity, and the value of asking questions. None of these are ever fashionable in film. Did you plan to address subjects that seemed almost ridiculously alien nowadays?
I wanted to celebrate that. I wanted to celebrate a love of learning and getting to do what you loved as a child for your entire life, and have that be a life of exploration and learning and friendship, you know, married with friendship, because you make friends with people in common interests. That's my subversive motive in making this film.
There's a decent chance that there are about 10 billion planets in this galaxy that might have life develop on them. And there are about 100 billion galaxies spread through the universe. And our success or failure is hopefully not important in the long run. We are just one of the many experiments necessary, and somewhere someone gets through.
One of the surprising things, and I think one of the things that will be a surprise when it screens at the festival, was that none of the four men are inclined towards sentiment at all. I wondered if this lack of sentimentality, which they must have as scientists, made making a film about them more difficult than it might have done.
Yes. Nick's just being extremely practical. And in fact, Wall was extremely sentimental, I would say, but he kept it well hidden. He's got a huge heart. And I think they all do. It was work, but filmmaking is work. And to be honest, they're also British, and they are of a certain age, a certain generation, and they're quite reserved and stoic, stiff upper lip, that kind of thing. So yes, it was hard, but I think we succeeded. I think there's real emotional resonance in the film.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Alison Rose for the interview, which she very generously squeezed into a very busy day. It was difficult to track that one down. As mentioned, Starman opens the Cambridge Film Festival with a screening this Thursday at 6:30 at the Arts Picture House. Alison is flying over for the screening and a Q&A. And I think some of the astronomers will be there as well. I'm not sure which ones, or if all of them will be. The film then enjoys a repeat screening at the Light Cinema on Friday, the 4th of September at 4 p.m. It's on page 6 of the film festival programme. With new release straight out of Compton, the ever-popular Hollywood music biopic reaches the hip-hop years. Directed by F. Gary Gary, the film tells the rapid rise and inevitable disintegration of NWA, the group that helped turn hip-hop from urban vernacular into a hugely influential force to be reckoned with. In the late 1980s, the feel-good factor of Reaganomics hadn't bothered with black America, and the depressed Californian city of Compton, low-end dope dealer Eazy-E, played by Jason Mitchell, is convinced by friend Dr. Dre to put his money into a recording studio and a new hip-hop group, NWA. A mashup of gangster rap and West Coast's heavy beats, NWA's first single, Boys in the Hood, is a runaway hit, instantly landing the group a manager, concert appearances, and an album contract. Fueled by Ice Cube's ferocious lyrics and Dr. Dre's production, the music touches a nerve, not just in Compton and not just in Los Angeles, but around the United States.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
People are scared of you guys. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want NWA? Let's give them NWA.
Straight out of Compton, crazy motherfucker named Ice Cube.
This is only the tip of the iceberg, gentlemen.
What's going on? What do you have in that bag?
Are you kidding me?
You can't take that in the bus.
When I'm called on, I got a sawed off. Squeeze the trigger, your body's all hard off.
Your songs glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
You guys supposed to be somewhere?
These are artists.
Rap is not an art.
You cannot come down here and harass my clients because of what they look like.
You want to be involved with this gangster life? Here we go.
Speak a little truth and people lose their mind.
Ed, it's fascinating to have NWA treated this way, because this is a very traditional music biopic. This could be the Glenn Miller story, it could be Ray, it could be Walk the Line. So that's kind of depressing in a way, but at the same time it's invigorating to have something that was so revolutionary put into this template.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming for hip-hop and rap to get, I guess, a cinematic limelight that a number of figures throughout rock and roll and pop history have
had.
Well,
the respectability of this sort of film, it's soundtracked widely, but this is very much welcome to the top table of...
Yeah, kind of.
Of generic popular Hollywood.
Yeah, and it's interesting that almost all these figures now have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and are now kind of accepted as mainstream music figures, which they weren't, obviously, at the time, as this film very much demonstrates. I would disagree that this is a run-of-the-mill dramatic kind of music biopic. You know, normally, music biopics focus on internal problems. If you think of sort of Walk the Line, it's problems of sort of genius and madness or difficulties of dealing with fame. It's all stuff that's internal. Whereas I think this film is very much about people coming from an area, coming from a society, people who have come straight out of Compton, as the film suggests, and how those problems linger with them regardless of how far up the chain they get. Even when they've made it, in inverted quotation marks, they're still dealing with all the problems that they still had when they were, you know, in Compton. They'd still have these managers who are taking them for a ride. They're still having to deal with the gangs who are messing around with their business. They cannot escape, or it takes a long time for them
to escape. No money's enough to escape. You escape one rung of one area of Compton, you think, oh, I'm out. And then they look around. Certainly there's one scene where Dr. Dre looks around and he's, I don't know, a millionaire at that stage and thinks, I've brought some of these problems. These problems are still here and I've got to be my own man. I've got to move up again.
And it's a messy film, but I think the fact that, I mean, because it's following so many different characters, but what it has is a constant through line through the police reports of the beatings and what it has is within these inner city areas and all these different figures, they all tie together in being about a group of people that have come from a society and from a one place and what that place is like and what the effects of that place has been when it's been projected onto America. And I think that's really interesting. I think that's, you know, the best thing about the film, really.
Simon, this is myth-building. I mean, it's produced by Dr. Dre and it's produced by Ice Cube, and Ice Cube's own son plays Ice Cube. And very well, those aren't problems, but it's very much, and again, this is fascinating as much as it might be a problem, but it's basically putting these, lionizing these people. It's putting this group on a pedestal, and it's a capstone to all of these careers and what Dr. Dre's done since, and which Ice Cube's done since.
I think a lot of these members are already on the pedestal. They're there because they got themselves there. I mean, I thought it was an absolutely fascinating film. It's, you know, a subject I didn't know anything about. I didn't know a history of the group, or, you know, even really what Dr. Dre or Ice Cube had done in the past. I know who they are now, but it's like, what they actually do, and now I know. You know, reading up on it, it does seem pretty accurate to the past, although there are some major omissions, which I'm sure you can see in the local tabloids and anything else if you really want to get an nitty-gritty of it. But I thought it was really enlightening. I mean, all the main cast members, especially Jason Mitchell, were absolutely fantastic.
They played Eazy-E.
Playing Eazy-E. You know, I believe, you know, they were pretty much who I saw on the screen. You know, You saw the characters, you saw what they did. If I had any complaints about the film, it'd be more like I would have seen more of the fallout throughout a lot of the events, you know, shown in the film. You didn't see much of the wider problems and about the, you know, the freedom of speech problems with the police. It touched on a lot of events, but which had wide ranging impact. But it didn't really go there because it kept it so personal. But there was just so much in this film, it would be hard to take any further.
Dave, did it feel rushed? I mean, it was 2.5 hours, which I didn't actually feel. I thought it was a bit shorter than that. But it does feel, even that doesn't seem quite enough time for this story.
It felt a bit rushed. Another thing that felt rushed was some of the camera work for me, which wasn't great because I was quite tired when I went to see it. And then there's a scene early on in the film, Dr. Dre's leaving his home, he's saying goodbye to his brother, and it's like the cameraman was drunk or maybe falling over the curve he was filming on all the time, because it was just like, they're having a conversation, can you stop shaking the camera around and just let me focus? No, you can't. So that was, you know, maybe...
It's trying to give it that sort of urgent edge, which it might not have otherwise.
It was actually a really nice kind of family moment. And it was just like, please treat it as such. Come on, just for a couple of seconds, calm down. You can run around after them on stage in, like, 5 minutes' time.
Did it get across the vitality of the music? Which the music becomes a bit sidelined about halfway through.
It would work nicely if the music was about moments like that, their music, but it wasn't. Their music was about the life that they were reflecting on the streets,
which wasn't their lives at all. They were clear. They were just.
I thought, like I said, I thought the music scenes were absolutely brilliant. When it hit the concert, you know, despite it's not something I would normally listen to, it's something I immediately want to go back and listen to, because when they went into concert, you could see the energy, you could see why it inspired the people, you can see why so many people loved it. You know, even if hip-hop and rap based on what you listen to, you will watch this movie and you will appreciate everything they did.
A little bit of wider context, perhaps, Ed? I mean, we see the Rodney King beating on the television. They showed a couple of times and how that influenced me. But there's nothing wider in this era of Ferguson and the situation not being improved in any shape or form. Perhaps a little bit more sort of the historical importance of NWA and of Ruthless Records and those gold records on the wall for a form of music that 2 years earlier would have been completely dismissed.
I think... In 20 seconds. I think that it has enough wider context that you can clearly attach it to things that we're seeing in news reports coming out of America almost every day. I think that it's good that... It felt to me like a film that didn't have a very obvious thing of what it was saying. It moved through personal things to wider political things almost seamlessly, and I quite liked the fact I had no idea what was coming next, and I enjoyed that.
Okay, all right. Well, Straight Outta Compton opened yesterday and is screening at the Light Cinema and the View Cinema Plus there, and it is a certificate 15. That's all for yet another week. Time marches relentlessly on, but we will be back in only 7 days on September the 5th with the first of our two specials from the Cambridge Film Festival. We'll have something on Victor Sjostrom, we'll have something on Microcinema, and we'll have reviews of films that you'll only be able to see at the film festival, films such as Bill. Stay tuned for Live from the Homegrown Festival, but from everybody here at Bums on the Seats, goodbye.